I'm Allison Keyes, and this is Tell Me More from NPR News. Michelle Martin is away. On the program later, it's Friday, and the guys in the barbershop are making their way to their respective chairs to discuss some of the latest news headlines, including that rally at the Lincoln Memorial on the anniversary of Martin Luther King's March on Washington speech. The rally's being organized by Fox News Channel's Glenn Beck. But first, the Tell Me More political chat begins today in Arizona. We're talking about the record number of black Republican candidates who've been running for Congress but have been struggling to get through their primaries to the November midterm election. Case in point, Vernon Parker in Arizona's 3rd Congressional District in the northern part of Phoenix in the suburbs. He was defeated in the primary this week by Ben Quayle, the son of the former vice president. Mr. Parker joins me now from Tempe. Good morning. Hello, Mr. Parker.
Hello. Thanks for having me.
The Republican National Committee was saying earlier this year that Republicans of color can get elected with significant white support while running on conservative principles. Is that not happening?
Well, you know, when I look at my own race, you know, we're currently tied for third place behind Ben Quayle, who's a former, who's the son of the former vice president, and another gentleman who is currently in second by, I think he probably has about 500 or 600 more votes than I have. Mm-hmm. He spent well over $1.1 million. Ben Quayle's father, he raised over $1.5 million. And we did extremely well. We, you know, considering that we didn't have the resources, we were outspent 4-1. I do believe that if we had the resources, this race would have been ours because we had close to 17% of the vote out of a 10-person primary. So that spoke volumes.
Let me play a little bit from an earlier conversation you had with Michelle Martin here on this show, talking about President Obama's victory and your encounter with the white woman voter.
Well, there was one funny experience that I had. This one woman, she came up to me. She was white, and she goes, you know, I was never a racist before until Barack Obama got elected. And I said, why? And she goes, well, I disagree with him on health care. I disagree with him on, you know, the border. I disagree with him on the massive bailouts. So I told her, I said, well, maybe you didn't get the memo. He is half white. That's his white side. Now, do you hate all white people? You know?
You're a man who says you haven't experienced racism, but I've got to ask, do you think?
Well, I didn't say that. No,
okay.
No, my goodness, no.
You've said that in a couple of places.
Well, no, absolutely, I definitely have experienced racism.
Okay, well, wait. Let me ask my question though. Do you think being African American in the district in which you ran, majority white, affluent, had anything at all to do with your defeat, or was it all about the money?
Well, look. Let me just explain this to you. Up until 1 month ago, I was the mayor of the town of Paradise Valley. Mm-hmm. Paradise Valley, Arizona is a very affluent suburb right next to Phoenix. Paradise Valley is 98% white, and I received 67% of the vote, the most votes in the town's history. So, you know, so I thought that spoke volumes for the people in the town of Paradise Valley. And we took that same, you know, thought and ideological path to run for Congress. Now, I most definitely was the most qualified person in this race. I mean, I was the former general counsel of a federal department. I was a former special assistant to the president of the United States. I was unanimously confirmed by the United States Senate. I was the mayor of a town. So, you know, when I look at this race and when I say that, with a town that's 98% white and I got 67% of the vote, the most votes in the town's history. So, that spoke volumes.
So you think the same thing is happening nationwide? The other black Republicans who lost their races were not about race. It was about other issues.
You know, I look at it like this. And I can only speak for my own race. Mm-hmm. If I had the money that Ben Quayle had, or if I had the name ID, there is no contest. And I can look. When you look at the qualifications between Ben Quayle and me, there was no comparison. I mean, he did not even come close to the qualifications. But it's unfortunate that we have an electorate that just look at someone's last name, or if you have a famous father who can fly around the country and raise close to $2 million or $1.5 million, and elections are decided like that. unfortunately. But we ran a very good race, first time running in a congressional race. We out of a 10-field primary,
and you made fourth out of that, which is
I think we're going to come in third though. But I believe
after all the votes are counted.
Yes, but we had more votes than five of the other candidates combined.
Mr. Parker, sorry, I've got to stop you here for a moment because I'm going to bring in a couple of other guests to join the conversation. But first, I want to play a clip from Republican Party Chair Michael Steele, who says he's been trying to expand the party's support base. He caught some flack from comments last year about integrating Republican principles in, quote, urban suburban hip-hop settings.
I'm talking about the Republican Party have an urban agenda, an agenda where our community lives, where our community is creating wealth, going to school, living and dying, and have something to say to them. I'm not trying to play off of hip-hop. I'm not trying to use hip-hop. What I'm trying to recognize is there's something of value that's happening in the community that's reflected on the economic side of hip-hop.
Mr. Parker, I hope you'll stay with us while I bring in two other guests. We have with us Kai Wright, editorial director of Color Lines magazine, and Sophia Nelson, a Republican strategist turned independent. She's now a contributor to TheRoot.com, The Washington Post, and Essence. Welcome to both of you.
Thank you.
Thanks for having me.
So, Kai, is the Republican Party really ready to push candidates of color? Are these candidates being set up to fail, or are they doing a good job at putting them out there?
Well, you know, they face a tough position, they being the party. You know, these are local elections, but they exist in a national context. And what's clear is that in the course of trying to get regain control of Capitol Hill in this election cycle, they've chosen to double down on a strategy that focuses on frustrated white men. And we've seen it with the 14th Amendment debate and a host of others. And I think that makes it difficult for the party to both recruit candidates and support the ones they've got in these elections.
Sophia, there hasn't been a black Republican in the House since 2003, I believe, when J.C. Watts left. What's going on with that?
Yeah, that's right. Let me say this, a little ancient history. In 1996, I was a candidate for Congress in New Jersey's 1st Congressional District, a Republican candidate. Christy Whitman was then governor. We had all the apparatus, the state party, et cetera, et cetera. And I was about 29 years old at that time. And while it was definitely a Democrat-leaning district, I had run countywide like the year before and gotten like some like 48% of the vote in a 3-1 Democrat county. And I grew up there, et cetera, so I had a good base. And I couldn't get support for that race. And I had nationalized it to the extent that, you know, we've talked about here a little bit this morning, you know, as one of the rising stars in the party at the time, you know, a black female, the New York Times covered it and all that. My point is this, Vernon's story is not unique. Now, he had a lot more qualifications to be a member of Congress. I wasn't a sitting mayor, et cetera, but, you know, a new young attorney, et cetera, et cetera. And the point is that nothing's changed. I'm sitting here as I'm listening to the dialogue this morning, and I'm shaking my head, and I'm saying this is why I've had a hard time with the Republican Party.
All right, Kai.
I've been in it since 1988.
Let me jump in here. Mr. Parker, do you think your party supported you the way it should have or could have?
Well, here's what. In my race in particular.
And I need a fairly short answer, sir.
Yes,
sorry.
The answer is I would have loved a lot more help, but we had over 1,100 donors. So given the complexity of our race with the former vice president's son, people were reluctant to jump in there.
But let me say this. The reason that Vernon has to respond the way he is, and I got a smile on my face, and I'm not trying to put words in his mouth. But
And briefly, Kai, go ahead.
Yes, careful with this because we hope he runs again. I know I'd like to see him be governor of Arizona someday or a U.S. senator. I don't want him beaten up on the party because that would not be positive for him to do. But I can. And I'm saying that this is nothing new. This is what they've done forever. And also, I think it's important for your listeners to know that most of the black candidates that run are running in districts where they wouldn't have a hope and a prayer of winning anyway.
Okay, Sophia, I need you to hold that thought. Kai, what chance do people of color have under the circumstances under which Sophia and Mr. Parker are talking?
Well, I don't think they've got a lot, to be honest. Even if the Republicans could really support these candidates, again, I think they create a national environment that's very difficult for them to be viable within the party. You know, you get more money and you get more support as you as you stand out as someone who can climb up the national rung. And as the National Party decides that it's doubling down on the Southern strategy, that makes it difficult to make a case for yourself as someone who's going to be an up and comer. I think the standout interesting case is, of course, Nikki Haley in South Carolina, who bucked the party and managed to win, and did it while leaning into the conversation about race and religion in some ways, using that to exploit media opportunities combined with just, you know, good old-fashioned retail politics. I think that's an interesting example of the kind of person of color that can win in a Republican race. But I think it's difficult when you have the national context of where the party's trying to lead.
But I also think, too, the important thing that I learned in my years in the party, and I think what Vernon has going for him that I think will work for him in the future, I mean, I think running against Ben Quayle was unfortunate for the reasons he mentioned. It didn't matter if Ben Quayle didn't have any experience or wasn't articulate or whatever it is that he wasn't able to do, and even had a little scandal going there, not bad.
Sophia, I need you to finish your thought.
And he basically won because he had the right last name.
Okay. Vernon Parker is the former mayor of Paradise Valley, Arizona, and former candidate for Arizona's 3rd District Congressional seat in the just-concluded primary. He joined us from member station KJZZ in Tempe. Kai Wright is editorial director of Color Lines magazine and joined us from New York. And Sophia Nelson is a columnist and contributor for Washington Post, Essence, BET, and TheRoot.com. She joined us here in Metro Washington, D.C. Thanks so much for a scintillating, if short, conversation.
Thank you. It was fun.
I'm Allison Keyes, and this is Tell Me More from NPR News. Michelle Martin is away. Coming up, you tell us more. You talk to us about this week's stories in our Back Talk segment. But first, this Sunday marks the 5th anniversary of Hurricane Katrina's landfall on the Gulf Coast, and we're turning inland for this part of our ongoing look at the region. In addition to massive damage from the hurricane itself, the cities of Baton Rouge, Louisiana, and Jackson, Mississippi received thousands of displaced people from New Orleans and from other cities near or along the coast. We're joined now by the mayors of both cities. In Baton Rouge, the office's mayor president. So, Mayor President Melvin Kip Holden of the city of Baton Rouge and East Baton Rouge Parish, and Mayor Harvey Johnson of Jackson, Mississippi, are here. Welcome to both of you.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you. Appreciate the opportunity.
Mayor Holden, let me start with you in Baton Rouge. You had just been sworn in a few months when Katrina hit. What happened in the initial impact from your city, and what did you think was going to happen after all those people started showing up?
Well, in the first week, we took in about 250,000 people. We exceeded
Wait, let me back up. 250,000?
Yes, 250,000 people. We exceeded our 25-year traffic projection in 1 week. And it was a lot of people who came here because initially the evacuation plan said start in North Louisiana and work your way back towards Southern Louisiana. I think a lot of people just said, you know, I'm going to try to get to the first shelter I can, and Baton Rouge became that first place where we started to take people in.
So you thought basically you gained a whole nother city within a week.
That's correct. But not only did we gain people like from New Orleans, we also helped to serve 7 other parish government entities. All of those parishes, we were able to keep them operating by offering them space in Baton Rouge.
Mayor Johnson, you had just left office just before the storm hit. Talk to us about your perspective. What did you think?
Well, you know, we just didn't anticipate the level of devastation because we were so far inland, but it was still a Category 3 storm when it reached Jackson. I mean, we experienced power outages, fuel shortages, those things that we just weren't accustomed to experiencing from a hurricane. We also experienced, of course, not 250,000 people, but we had a sizable influx of evacuees. We had about 50,000 people here in the city. So, you know, we were sort of stretched both from the devastation, from the influx of people. So it was very trying times. And then we had debris all over the place. So these are the kinds of challenges that we hadn't experienced before here in the city. I was not in office. I was observing as a citizen, but the experience
and
some of the same.
And then you came back 4 years later, right? You were just reelected last year.
Yes, I was just reelected this past summer, yes.
Mayor Holden, right after the hurricane,
I know you were just saying that your population, I mean, nearly doubled, and then you've got overcrowded schools, you've got overcrowded streets, but it also allowed some opportunities. Let's take a listen to what then-chief administrator for the East Baton Rouge Parish, Mr. Walter Mansour, told an NPR reporter in 2005.
We're talking about law firms, CPAs, consulting services, engineering. A lot of those companies had offices in Baton Rouge. Typically, the larger office was in New Orleans, the smaller office in Baton Rouge. That's certainly going to change. The larger office is now going to be in Baton Rouge, and if they reestablish an office in New Orleans at all, it will be a smaller office.
Mayor Holden, is that still the case?
That's still the case. We have been pretty vibrant in regards to the number of people who still want to locate here if they're not located here already. We're also watching some new companies that are coming here and doing more. But I guess one other offshoot is 2005. We had not started a film commission. Mainly the movies were being made for the most part in New Orleans and in Shreveport. And now a lot of those big players out of California are shooting major movies here, including the last episode of Twilight will be filmed in Baton Rouge.
Oh, my goodness, the Twihards.
Yeah.
Mayor Johnson, talk to us a little bit about how many people first came to your city, how many have stayed, and what kind of people they were. Are they professional? Are they blue-collar?
Well, they're mostly blue-collar, I would believe. There are some professionals who are here. But for the most part, you know, the people who've stayed here are seeking work opportunities here, housing opportunities here. But I don't think the number is as significant as in other areas.
What kind of changes, Mayor Johnson, has it meant for your city? I mean, I've been to Jackson a few years ago, and it was a lovely but sleepy little town. And this was around 2007, because I was speaking to a family that actually relocated there from New Orleans.
I think the main change that that we see is just the way we look at emergency management, emergency planning right now. I mean, setting up these temporary support services that have to be just as effective as permanent support services, making sure that we bring into our planning churches and nonprofits, because at the end of the day, they really were the institutions that stepped forward and provided these a level of service that we in government, quite frankly, was not prepared to provide or could provide. So it's affected us in the way we look at emergency management planning. And we're going to go forward with our plan, but making sure that we form the partnerships that can help us accommodate the needs of the people who are coming here for help and for refuge.
I'm curious about something, because I remember in the immediate aftermath that in the first couple of years, there were a lot of news reports from cities where residents along the Gulf had moved, and people accused them basically of being criminals. They're going, we have this huge influx of people, they're robbing people, they don't have anywhere to be, they're bringing down property values. I wonder if you guys have run into that kind of thing, and let me ask Mayor Johnson to speak first.
Well, you know, I think that people just traditionally, I guess, or sometimes are leery of strangers coming into that neighborhoods. But when you have a massive influx like we had, there's even more anxiety, so to speak. I haven't heard, and we haven't experienced any, you know, widespread accusations that we have criminals and all that. In fact, what we've tried to do is to make sure that we can accommodate these people who are coming in. But, you know, that was a little anxiety at first, but nothing, I haven't heard of any reports where people were being accused of being criminals simply because they were displaced by the storm.
Mayor Holden, what was your experience?
Basically the same as Mayor Johnson, except, you know, we had to deal with all the rumors back then. Although you had delays on radio stations and their equipment, radio stations here were allowing people to go on the air, basically say whatever they wanted to say, and there was no time delay at all. And so what that did was allow rumors to go out, for example, that they had commandeered all of the Walmart stores, that people from New Orleans were walking down the streets with shotguns in their hands, and that they were pulling women out of the cars at red lights and raping them and all of these different things. And one reporter I remember who told me, she says, Mayor, there was also a rumor they had kidnapped you. And I responded to her by saying, if they had kidnapped me, it would have been bad news because my wife would not have paid the ransom. And so, but, you know, but we survived, and we've had small incidents, but for the most part, The crime that we're seeing here, most of it is being committed by people who grew up in Baton Rouge. So New Orleans did not have that much of an adverse impact on us and crime in Baton Rouge.
Mayor Holden, isn't the Justice Department investigating some complaints against the police department there for the way they allegedly behaved in the aftermath of the storm?
They have conducted their investigation, and they found no wrongdoing on the part of the police department. They had some problems with, I guess, how some officers may have talked to some of the individuals. I do not condone that at all. But overall, this department here, for example, has just received the top accreditation of any department in the United States. 22 cities and states received that accreditation, and they have been named a flagship department. So, yet there could have been a few bad apples, but we have indicated and told them we're not going to tolerate this foolishness if you don't take care of crime. Some of it, you are going to offend somebody.
The New Mexico State Police forwarded complaints, though, to the U.S. Department of Justice. So you're telling us that investigation is over and
done
with?
Yes, ma'am, I am.
Okay, I'm just trying to be clear.
Yeah.
We spoke with a family who moved from New Orleans to Jackson, Mississippi, Mayor Johnson, and they were saying that while your city is beautiful, they really, really want to go home to New Orleans. And I wonder, both of you and Mayor Johnson, if you could answer first, have you had to do anything to help families that are trying to relocate back to New Orleans or Gulfport or whatever other city they came from?
Well, certainly we want to try to accommodate their needs as best we can, but, you know, I would be misleading you if I said that we would try to help people to relocate out of our city. We want
right.
We want to bring people into our city, and so we do not have a relocation program that would assist people in moving back. We'll accommodate them as best we can, but our hope is that they stay here in the city of Jackson and they help us grow and develop the city.
Mayor Holden, you feel the same way in Baton Rouge? You would rather that the people that have come stay there?
Yes, we would. And I think one of the things that we found out is it's kind of amazing. We're only an hour and 10 minutes away from New Orleans. But the most interesting thing has been people saying, basically, I didn't realize the city was so nice. And so what we had was a cultural and social barrier erected between two cities. And those barriers are now broken down. Matter of fact, Mayor Mitch Landrieu and myself have signed a sister city agreement to make sure we share everything with each other. So the bottom line is simply we then take our services that we could offer to help children in school, summer youth programs, and other programs we offer to people, including training programs to help them get jobs.
Basically, it sounds to me like both of you are thinking this is the new normal for your city. You're not looking for another, you know, big swash of people going back and forth. Either way, these are the people that are there now. It's been 5 years, so they're now part of your cities. Am I right?
Yes, but I think both of us would agree that everybody is watching the next month and a half to 2 months because that's the top of the hurricane season, and we are hoping and praying that we don't have a storm anywhere close to the magnitude of Katrina, because you're going to see massive problems throughout whatever area another major storm would hit.
And beside the storm, of course, we have the devastation of what has happened out in the Gulf with the oil. I mean,
right.
The coast, is Mississippi coast, is rebounding. In fact, a lot of it has to do with perception rather than reality as to the devastation there. But because of that perception, they have undergone a downturn in the economy, and certainly a major storm would just aggravate that. And so I too, like Mayor Holden, hope and pray that we don't experience another Katrina this coming season.
Mayor Johnson, really briefly, with them basically saying that, okay, the oil is all dissipated, this is all fine, what are you hearing from people that work in the seafood industry in your city?
That the seafood is fine, and that, you know, we need to make sure that we get that word out. I think the media did a great job in keeping us informed on the oil spill. In fact, it was a lead story for days and days and days. And now I think people outside of our area are a little leery of the seafood, but the seafood is fine. And we want to make sure, and I'm sure that the fishermen and the people involved in the industry want to make sure that Gulf Coast seafood is just as fine as it always has been, and that we need people to buy just as they have in the past. But also, we're getting up to the last major holiday of the summer, the Labor Day, and people are still think that there are globs of oil on the beaches down on the coast, and that's simply not the case. And so we're also hoping that people will take the opportunity to spend some time on the Gulf Coast and to have fun, and of course, to help rejuvenate the economy that suffered because of this oil situation.
Harvey Johnson is the mayor of Jackson, Mississippi, and Melvin Holden is the mayor president of Baton Rouge, Louisiana. They both joined us from their offices. Thank you, gentlemen, for sharing.
Thank you for the opportunity, and our prayers go out still to all of those Katrina victims and those who are trying to rebuild their lives.
Yeah, thank you so much for the opportunity to share my thoughts with you.
And now we turn to Back Talk, where Tell Me More lifts the curtain on what's happening in the Tell Me More blog universe, and where we get to hear from you, the listeners, where producer Douglas Hopper is sitting right here with me. Hey, Douglas.
Hi, Allison. Welcome back to the host chair.
Thank you. I know you're going to talk about the response to the Antoine Dotson interview, but what else are people talking about on our comment thread?
Well, Allison, there was a good amount of feedback on our mom's discussion this week about when, if ever, it's appropriate to step in when you think a parent has gone too far disciplining a child. Case in point, a mom on a recent Southwest Airlines flight allegedly smacked her 13-month-old in the face. A flight attendant got in the mix and actually took the baby from the mom.
Uh-oh.
One of our regular moms, Danny Tucker, says she's been on both sides of the situation, and sometimes she says you just got to step in, but with tact.
As a young mother, when my son was young, and I snatched him up in a grocery store, I'll never forget it. But the mother that helped me was nice. She said, you know what, I understand what you're doing, but let's go to the bathroom and do that. Just like the mother that did to me, it's all in the way that you do it.
So what did listeners have to say?
Well, we heard from plenty of parents and non-parents who said there is absolutely no excuse for ever slapping or spanking or snatching your kid. But here's another perspective from Penny in Orville, Ohio. She says the problem is that we put too much pressure on children to act like adults.
Young children, especially under the age of 5, are constantly drug around from store to store, strapped in and out of car seats, and thrown into shopping carts. And the children, well, they're just expected to sit there and behave.
Douglas, I have to ask about Antoine Dotson. We spoke with him earlier this week from Huntsville, Alabama. He's the man made famous after appearing in a local newscast because he fought off his sister's attacker.
Obviously, we have a rapist in Lincoln Park. He's climbing in your windows. He's snatching your people up, trying to rape them. So y'all need to hide your kids, hide your wife, and hide your husband because they're raping everybody out here.
The broadcast and a music video based on Mr. Dotson's words has garnered more than 10 million hits on YouTube. I asked Antoine Dotson about his sudden fame.
Everywhere I go, if somebody stops, hey, you're the YouTube guy, or you're Antoine, oh, you're my hero, and that's pretty cool when people can sit and say, you're a hero, you know, like, that's really cool.
Lots of love for Dotson in the comment thread. What about his instant celebrity? What do people have to say about that?
Well, after hearing from Dotson himself, we turned to two commentators, tech blogger Mario Armstrong and writer and comedian Baratunde Thurston. They talked about whether Dotson was what some have described as a caricature of a black and openly gay man whose family lives in public housing. Basically, is America laughing with or at Antoine Dotson? Casey Young heard the discussion and appreciated what they had to say, but Casey was disappointed we didn't keep Dotson in the conversation. Quote, I know he was interviewed beforehand, but it was telling that one of the concerns the guests had was that Antoine would be essentially objectified, and yet he became just that in the conversation that followed his interview, an object to discuss rather than a person with whom everyone should have conversed.
Thanks for your thoughts, everyone, and thanks, Douglas.
Of course.
The conversation on Tell Me More never ends. To tell us more, you can call our comment line at 202-842-3522. Remember to leave your name and tell us how to pronounce it. You can also log on to our website, go to npr.org, click on Programs, and then on Tell Me More. Blog it out.
You don't have to come and confess. We're looking for you. We gon' find you. We gon' find you.
I'm Allison Keyes, and this is Tell Me More from NPR News. Now we head to the barbershop where the guys talk about what's in the news and what's on their minds. Sitting in the chairs this week are freelance writer Jimmy Israel, Johns Hopkins University political science professor Lester Spence, Republican strategist Ron Christie, and civil rights attorney and editor Arsalan Iftikhar. Take it away, Jimmy.
Thanks, Allison. How you doing?
I'm good. How you doing?
good to have you back in the chair.
Thank
Chi-town.
You.
Yo, fellas. Welcome to the shop. How we doing?
Hey, hey, hey.
Hey.
What's going on?
Man, I don't know. What's going on in New York, man? One cabbie, he got caught up in some kind of racist pop quiz. And next thing you know, he gets stabbed multiple times, Allison.
Yeah, that's 44-year-old Ahmed Sharif. He picked up 21-year-old Michael Enright. Somewhere along the way, Enright learned his driver is Muslim. They started talking about Ramadan, and then Enright made jokes about it. And then he said, quote, "This is a checkpoint. I have to bring you down." He took out a knife and slashed the driver's neck and stabbed him. Sharif spoke about it on WABC.
You see this on the neck?
Yeah.
And then again he stabbed me. Then I'm trying to hold him, and I'm telling him, please do not kill me. I'm very hard work. I work very hard.
The murder suspect is a volunteer with a group that supports religious and cultural diversity, as well as the building of the Islamic Center near Ground Zero.
Thanks for that, Allison. This is really, really sad. Ron, RC.
Yo.
My man, welcome back to the shop. You're in New York City right now. What's the view from the ground, bro?
I have to tell you, I think people here in New York City are very, very concerned about the lack of cultural and religious sensitivity in light of the decision to build a mosque near Ground Zero. My wife and I were in a cab two nights ago, and the cab driver asked us, you know, what are you feeling? What are you sensing about this mosque? And we said that while the individuals had the constitutional right to build it there, we were in Washington on 9/11 when it was struck, and we understand the sensitivities of some people. So there are a lot of heated emotions on both sides of the issue, but this crazy kid, I mean, this type of violence cannot be tolerated, and fortunately the cab driver is alive and this individual is in custody.
A-Train.
Yeah, well, let's call it what it is. It's a hate crime. And you know what it teaches us is that hate speech in America eventually leads to bias-motivated crimes, regardless of who the victim is. It could be anti-Latino violence, it could be homophobic, homosexual violence, it could be anti-Muslim violence. Hate speech eventually does lead to hate crimes. What it reminds me of is 3 days after 9/11, when we had the first post-9/11 hate crime murder occur in Mesa, Arizona, with a Chevron gas station attendant named Balbir Singh Sodhi, who was an Indian Sikh man. He was not even a Muslim or an Arab, but the fact that he wore a turban on his head and had a beard, a 44-year-old man named Frank Roque came in, shot him point blank, and as he was being taken away, he kept screaming at the television cameras, "I'm an American, I'm the true patriot." This is exactly what is wrong with America today, and that is why we need hate crimes legislation across the board.
It does seem like the rhetoric's getting crazy.
Brother, if I can go ahead and put this out here right quick, A-Train, I've said this to a number of my friends, but I'll just go ahead and say this to you personally. I love you like a brother, and I really want you to be careful out there. You understand? People are acting crazy. So please, please be careful out there, brother.
Oh, that's very kind of you. And actually, I have friends in New York who are saying that, you know, I'm trying to get cab drivers, and they have all four doors locked. Cab drivers in New York are scared to death right now. They don't know what to do and what to think.
The cab drivers here in Washington are pretty afraid as well.
Yeah.
We got Lester?
Yeah, the hate crime data isn't necessarily quote-unquote clean, but from the Southern Poverty Law Center indicates that a number of types of hate crimes are on the rise, and it's important that on the one hand we isolate this incident, but on the other we connect it, as some of the other panelists have, to a wider set of not only rhetoric but also economic anxiety combined with populist racist rhetoric tends to lead to support for racist policies, and it tends to lead to incidents like this, and it's really, really deeply, deeply problematic. We should all be concerned.
Let me just jump in here for a minute and say, if you're just joining us, this is Tell Me More from NPR News. We are in the middle of our weekly visit to the barbershop. This week, we've got Jimmy Israel, Lester Spence, Ron Christie, and Arsalan Iftikhar. Jimmy, to you.
Thank you. All right, fellas, as you know, not only does this weekend mark the anniversary of Hurricane Katrina's landfall, it also marks the anniversary of the March on Washington, and the I Have a Dream speech at the Lincoln Memorial.
That's right, Jimmy. Fox News Channel's Glenn Beck is planning to hold a rally there tomorrow. He says it's to honor military families.
What an appropriate day. At first, we picked that date. We didn't know, and I thought, oh, geez. But now I think it was almost divine providence. I do. His dream has been so corrupted. It's time we pick that dream back up and we finish the job.
You know, thanks for that, Allison. I'm not sure if Glenn Beck is the best arbiter of the dream. Doc, Spence, help me out here.
Well, there's one problem with using Martin Luther King's language in general, in that he's not alive to talk about this. But to the extent we can use his words, I've got a couple of quotes. I probably only have time for one, but given the last story, I want to leave with it. This is from Martin Luther King. Here is the true meaning and value of compassion and nonviolence. When it helps us to see the enemy's point of view, to hear his questions, to know his assessment of ourselves. For from his view, we may indeed see the basic weakness of our own condition, and if we are mature, we may learn and grow and profit from the wisdom of the brothers who are called the opposition. And that says it all right there.
Some civil rights leaders have been, and activists are not, having, shall we say, too much faith in what Glenn Beck is doing. Although Beck himself has basically said, well, blacks don't own Martin Luther King, and King's ideas have been purposely distorted.
Well, whatever.
Listen.
Go ahead, man.
Listen, Glenn Beck is no Dr. King. He is no Dr. Seuss. He is no Dr. Pepper. He is no Dr. Dre or Dr. Ruth, because we know she was a stone-cold gangster.
Dr. Pepper?
Listen, putting Glenn Beck and Martin Luther King in the same sentence is like putting Don Imus and Malcolm X in the same sentence.
Ouch.
You know, this is a person who called the president of the United States, Barack Obama, a racist. And now he's going to talk about, you know, that he is the new civil rights vanguard for the millennium. Last time I checked, he was a white, conservative Christian male. Since when have they been oppressed in America?
I think
so long as I could tell.
Right, yeah, he needs to back away from the civil rights iconography. RC, help me out.
I agree with you on that, Jimmy, but I think people need to chill out here. I mean, if you look at the original speech, it wasn't the I Have a Dream speech. It was the March on Washington for Jobs and Freedom. And right. I believe that King's vision and his dream was that people could have the opportunity to speak out, to voice their opinions, and to do it in a respectful fashion. I'm not a particularly strong fan of Glenn Beck. In fact, I really don't like his show at all. But he has the right. He has the opportunity to go to the mall. He filed a permit. People should just wait and listen to see what he has to say before ascribing all these negative motivations to it. I mean, I've heard that there could be upwards of 100,000 people on the mall and the riot police are being called out. We need to just stop and see what's going to happen as opposed to assuming the worst and assuming there's going to be a riot. People need to chill out.
To your point, RC, I'm feeling that. It's just I don't appreciate him pimping the dream any more than I appreciate other people trying to misuse civil rights stuff. You know, that's what messes me up.
I agree with you. But again, this isn't a iconic anniversary. I mean, it's the 47th. It's not the 50th. It's not the 25th. I mean, let's just wait to see what the guy has to say. Everyone right now, and this is what worries me, Jimmy, everyone right now is on pins and needles about racial and cultural sensitivity. I think we're at a pivotal point in our history. If we don't stop inflaming issues, I think this country is going to be torn apart rather than brought together like Dr. King wanted us to be.
Glenn Beck
go ahead
said,
get the last word.
Sorry. I was going to say, when Glenn Beck says that it was quote-unquote divine providence, talk about making some hype about this, you know, speech.
He did say that.
And if I see one poster with President Obama with a Hitler mustache, I hope that one is played on the evening news so we can see exactly what kind of people are at this rally.
Well, again, wait a second. I'm a conservative. I take offense to that. Look, Glenn Beck's he's an entertainer. He's an entertainer. Okay. They're nuts everywhere. If there's a nut out there with a picture, that doesn't mean that all conservatives are nuts. And that's what upsets me about what people in the liberal media try to portray conservatives.
Noted. Let him get that out there, and let's keep it in motion, shall we?
Absolutely.
Now, all right. Now, as it happens, speaking of nutty ideas, the feds are out there putting out feelers for what they call Ebonics translators. Now, for those of you that don't know, African American vernacular English, most commonly called Ebonics, is a mixture of standard English with African language structure. Now, federal agents think these translators can help interpret wiretap conversations related to drugs. Now, for those of you that don't know, this isn't really a new idea. I mean, back in the late 70s, a guy named Joseph Pistone was chosen to infiltrate the New York Italian mafia precisely because he was Sicilian and understood the peculiar idioms of the community. He even wrote a book about it, which was made into a movie that you may have heard of, Donnie Brasco.
Right.
So this really isn't a new idea. Yeah, you want first in, Doc?
Yeah, there are a few different problems. One is resources, I think, will be better used towards other means of dealing with the drug war rather than surveillance and prosecution. But second, the big money in drugs isn't necessarily conducted on the streets by kids speaking Ebonics. It's conducted in the halls of power. You know, so that's another way it's a misuse of resources. But as far as the idea itself, I mean, Ebonics is a language, and in as much as kids speak it, I think we should treat it as if we're at least a dialect deserving of respect. So that minor point I can agree with. Everything else is a bad policy.
Yo, Doc, forget about it. RC, RC, help me out, man. What's your take?
Ebonics.
I know, man. I was getting my Donnie Brasco
trying
on.
To find one. You couldn't find one, could you?
I was getting my Donnie Brasco on, homie.
You were working it.
The area.
Look, this is nuts. At a time when our children are falling behind other nations in the world in reading comprehension and writing, the last thing the federal government needs to do is to be spending and wasting resources on Ebonics. I mean, I'm a native Californian. I remember back in the late 1970s where they had that resolution in Oakland that spent far too much time talking about Ebonics and diverting money and far too little attention on educating the children in the classroom. Let's keep our eye on the children rather than wasting money on Ebonics.
Gentlemen. Hold on. RC, I'm taking issue with all of that, but obviously the point isn't about the FBI and Ebonics. The point is whatever it takes to get drugs off the street because, you know, Donnie Brasco, Joseph Pistone, he brought down a crime family.
Hey,
so hold on a second, brother. Whatever it takes, right? Whatever it takes, RC. Are you going to go out there and fight the war on drugs?
Absolutely. Actually, I am. I am a member of the Boys and Girls Club Board in Washington, D.C., and I think there are far more constructive ways to make sure that children come off the streets, to make sure that children have a different path forward. But I'm saying, at this time, is it really in the best interest of the government to waste those resources for Ebonics to take drugs off the street? There are far more effective ways to do so than that.
Hey, and where's the Ebonics class being taught for them in the first place?
A-Train.
Jimmy, my only question for you is going to be, you know, if I took AP Ebonics in high school, would I be able to, you know, fast-track past the evaluation exam?
For people that don't understand about what the whole thing about African-American vernacular English was about, what it was about teachers using, quote-unquote, Ebonics as a pathway to teach children about standard English. That's what that whole thing was about.
True.
And the argument got twisted, just like it's getting twisted right now. Because this doesn't have anything to do with teaching kids Ebonics or giving the big ups to Ebonics. This has to do with using one tool to take drugs off the street.
This is Dr. Spence again. Yeah, this is
Go ahead,
it's
Don,
really
get
important.
It.
Yeah, it's really, really important to understand the distinction between the drug policy and the education policy thing, right?
Right.
Because empirically, RC's my man, but he's absolutely wrong when he talks about what Ebonics was used for in the Oakland case, right?
Right.
So you can put that on the side, and then the question becomes, okay, you've got these kids who are dealing drugs on the street, and they're causing problems, but to what extent should we be using resources to deal with them as opposed to the people who are really, really, really moving weight? That's the
issue. Forget about it.
That is a whole nother issue.
All right. Moving on. So the world's number one golfer, he's back on the market, ladies, officially.
Oh, wow. Let me go get some new shoes. Okay, no,
I know,
seriously.
Right? Tiger Woods'
divorce. Tiger Woods.
His divorce is finalized from wife Ellen this week.
Ellen, whatever.
Yeah, it's all done. It's a wrap.
And apparently, you know, maybe his golf game will get better because he himself has said it's been on a downward spiral. Well, since then, the Thanksgiving weekend car crash that spawned wild allegations of sexual infidelity, and then women just started coming out of the woodwork.
I mean, they're falling out the trees like apples, like who too?
Apples?
or bad apples, right?
Wow. Why are they bad? The women are bad.
Look, don't
he's
get me started.
Bad. Come on, Jimmy.
Don't get me started about. Don't get me started. A-Train. Right. Exactly. You know, I'm a one woman man, right?
Yeah.
A-Train.
Like,
better
know,
be.
When this.
Yeah. Does Tiger's divorce do anything to change your opinion of him?
No, not at all.
And his misdeeds.
Not at all. And when the story first broke here on the barbershop, the first thing I said on behalf of all married men, keep your Tiger Woods in your pants. And I say that to this day. And I still think, listen, I think ever since.
That's Ebonics, right?
I think ever since.
I think he's been downgraded right now from Tiger Woods to Cheetah Woods, and he needs to, you know, get back up to Tiger Woods. And to his credit, though, after the divorce was finalized, he apparently shot his best round ever in this last year, because he's been, you know, in a big slump right now. So
he did say he learned a lot about himself.
Hoo-ha! RC, get the last word, man. RC, get the last word, man.
I think it's sad. I think it's sad that he entered a sacred union with his wife and he betrayed the trust with her. They have two beautiful children. And I really worry the most about the kids and their impact of having a father who is a philanderer. Tiger will go on. He'll make his money. Elon has her millions. But I worry about those two beautiful kids.
I must say, they both have said that they are all about the kids and they're concerned about the kids and they will do their best to make sure that the kids are okay.
Yeah, I'm glad that it appears as if Tiger has gotten the custody deal that he wanted. That was my concern, that Elon was going to take his kids and abscond to, you know, Switzerland or somewhere else. But apparently he got the deal he wanted, and that's what's up. Shared parenting is rough, but, you know, if you get a good custody deal, it can be okay.
A few hundred million dollars always helps.
Yeah, seriously.
There's that. Gentlemen know what time it is. Jimmy Israel is freelance journalist and author of the book, The Denzel Principle. He's joined us from member station WCPN in Cleveland. Lester Spence is political science professor at Johns Hopkins University, and joined us from Baltimore. Civil rights attorney and editor Arsalan Iftikhar spoke right here in our Washington, D.C. studios. And Ron Christie is a Republican strategist and head of Christie Strategies in Washington, D.C. Thank you, gentlemen.
Peace.
Bye.
Peace.
Yep, yep.
And that's our program for today. I'm Allison Keyes. This is Tell Me More from NPR News. Let's talk more next week.